Tarlehurst End Podcast.
Read the blog
on thetarlehurstend.com.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Tarlehurst End Podcast. My name's Dan Wimbridge, editor of thetarlehurstend.com. It's not a full episode of the show this week. It is the international break, so therefore not a lot of Reading action to comment on unless you wanted me to delve into the under-21s 2-0 home defeat to Yeovil the other night in the Checker Trade Trophy. I was there. I can tell you that I would struggle to fill 5 minutes with analysis, yet alone an hour. The youngsters, to be fair, and they did okay, but they were just undone by a professional outfit who had an experienced striker that tipped the balance just after half time. And anyway, they're through to the next round. They'll play Southampton's under-21s in the first knockout stage. That's in a few weeks' time. And as for the seniors, it's back in action against Burton in just a few days' time. We'll obviously have a full show looking back at that game and ahead to the rest of a busy championship calendar as we head into those long winter months. But this week's show, as mentioned, is just a special edition, really. On Friday, the 11th of November, I sat down with the club's commercial director, Adam Benson, and the club's head of communication, Mark Bradley, to cover a wide range of topics ranging on all things from DJ Mega Party to the kits, how much choice the club has with that, the role of social media today, how the jobs change, what they hope from fans going forward, and the overall message to come out of the show, and I hope you'll appreciate that and you'll hear when you have what the guys have to say, is that they really want a dialogue going between fans and the club. They don't want it to seem like it's the club on one side, the fans on the other. This is something that they don't want. They want it all to be one and for an open dialogue to be in. And I'd just like to thank them. You know, I mentioned it a couple of times during the interview itself, but a massive thank you to both Mark and Adam for giving up their time on a weekday. They've got work to do. It's the international week, but it's still lots to be done. So for them to sit down, they gave me well over an hour of their time, and I can only thank them from our point of view here at the Tarlehurst End. And just before we do get on to that interview with Adam and Mark, just a very quick plug, and above all, a thank you to everyone who has taken part in the latest crowdfunding campaign that we've just launched. We've moved over to patreon.com. And it's been overwhelming to see several people take that call to arms and give their hard-earned cash over to us here and make those donations. It is very, very much appreciated. And if you'd like to join in with that, you can head over to patreon.com/thetarlehurstend. That's patreon.com/thetarlehurstend, P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And then hopefully you know how to spell the Tarlehurst End by now. But anyway, that about does it. And as I said, here is that interview with Mark and Adam.
The Tarlehurst End Podcast.
By Reading fans, for Reading fans.
Hello and welcome to a special Tarlehurst End Podcast. I am sat here in an executive box at the Badeski Stadium, sat here talking to the club's head of communications, Mark Bradley. Mark, hello.
Hello.
And the club's commercial director, Adam Benson. Adam, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for both taking the time to join us. It's international week. Does that mean that you guys have got a bit of an easier schedule?
Slightly easier. Obviously, there's no football driving the content on the website or on the social media, so we have to conjure up our own content and try and find stories elsewhere. So sometimes it makes a bit more work for us rather than less work, but it's a bit quieter in the office and a bit more relaxed.
On the commercial front, Adam, Christmas coming up. Does it mean you're ramping up, trying to get those little gifts and stuff in people's stockings?
Yeah, we've got a few things going on at the moment. So we'll ramp up hospitality sales, a lot of things around merchandise, Christmas photo shoots, etc. We've just gone on sale with half-season tickets as well. So a lot going on. There's no such thing as a quiet time during working for a football club, unfortunately. But
absolutely not. 52-week-a-year job these days. Well, let's go from the start. Mark, I'll start with you. Just tell us a bit about yourself. How you got into this job and basically what you do.
Sure. So I always wanted to work in journalism and sports media from an early age. Went to university, came out of university, and first thing I did was go to Wimbledon, which is the All England Lawn Tennis Club. Got a job there, working in the sort of the broadcast and TV marketing side of things. Did two tournaments there, and then got a job here at Reading in September 2004, and basically I started from the bottom and did everything that you need to do within a communications department. So that included taking photos, editing highlights, filming second angles, writing website stories, interviewing players, interviewing managers, editing. Then it went on to editing programs and writing program content. And it's, you know, I've done pretty much every aspect of it, press releases. And as the years went by, I sort of moved up and up and got more senior within the department. And a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago, I took over the department overall. And yeah, that's where I am now. I mean, I've seen quite a lot of things go on at the football club. A couple of promotions, a couple of relegations, two different ownership takeovers, six or seven different managers. Four or five FA Cup quarterfinals, an FA Cup semi-final, playoff final. So, you know, I've been involved in all of that, and it's been very enjoyable, to be honest.
It's like you've come through the club's back behind the scenes academy, almost.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I think in the communications department, what you need to do is be a jack of all trades, but a master of many of them, if possible. So you've got to be able to do the bare bones, even if it's, you know, take a photo of this community appearance here, or it's speak to the owner on an issue that he has to talk about in the media. There's a whole range of things you have to do in the communications department. And so learning from the bottom and learning to do absolutely every aspect of it can only help someone in my position, in my opinion.
With football being we said it earlier, it's 52 weeks a year, 365 days a year, there's something going on. I mean, how often do you work? Do you work a Monday to Friday? Do you work Monday, Tuesday, Saturday?
No, we work, so generally work Monday to Saturday. So it's 9 to 5.30, Monday to Friday. And then in our department, pretty much one of the only departments, apart from the football side of things, obviously, we're one of the only departments who works every game home and away. So we travel up and down independently on the Saturdays usually. And we follow the team home and away and do all the post-match and pre-match stuff that surrounds the matches. So we work 6 days a week. And also, as you probably know, media is a 24/7 affair. So even on Sundays, we have to make sure we time content out or do some work on a Sunday morning to make sure that stuff is going out, like the highlights at midday on a Sunday, for example. Some of the post-match stuff from the Saturday would go out on the Sunday. So we do work that's timed in, or we do work ourselves on a Sunday as well. So it's sort of 6 days a week, bit of work on a Sunday, and then we get a little bit of time off, time in lieu that we can accrue throughout the week.
How many people are in your team at the moment?
We have four people in our team, in the comms team, three which are primarily to do with the football side of things, and one who has a slightly more marketing element to it, but working at a football club, he gets involved in the football content as well. So we have two that look after the digital content primarily, one who looks after sort of sponsorship activations and different marketing projects that we have got going on, and then myself, who heads up and oversees the whole department.
Excellent. Adam, what about yourself? How did you end up at Reading Football Club?
Bit of a varied route and very different to Mark. I've always worked in sales and events. Probably got into sport about 10 years ago. Before that, I've a whole host of different things. I was a tour manager for Atomic Kitchener for a certain amount of time. I've been an estate agent.
Almost could do a whole another podcast on that.
There's your headline.
I could do it on my my varied career. I've run a restaurant in the south of France. Whole different things. I made contact probably about 10 and a half years ago now. I started working with Alex Stewart, the old England cricket captain, and Alan Smith, who was used to manage Crystal Palace. They had an agency which managed a lot of the England cricket team, and Gareth Southgate and Chris Coleman at the time. So I started working for them. I was probably there for about a year and a half, and then eventually moved to Masters Football, which is the old six-a-side Sky Sports tournament, indoor football. So I helped the two owners run that for about 5.5 years. And that was a whole host of different jobs there. Sponsorship, booking venues, booking players.
Why did you never book a Reading team?
Do you know what
the old podcast had a campaign at one stage going to get a Reading team in the Masters.
That campaign, I think it was run by Richard Wixon as well. He was very, very keen on that. It was mainly to do with venues. Trying to get venues. The nearest venue we had was Wembley. And fans didn't travel very far for Masters football. Oh. So actually Reading, it was just a bit too far. There was talk at the time that Bristol were going to open an indoor arena. And if they had have done, we would have done an event with Reading.
Oh.
But unfortunately, it just didn't happen.
What could have been?
Would have been great, though. It would have been great.
Absolutely. So you moved in there, and then how did you end up at Reading?
And then, so I was with Masters football for about 5.5 years. Job came up here, got approached about it. Originally, it was a head of sales role. So looking after hospitality and some of the advertising. Got offered the job. There were very few football clubs, if I'm brutally honest, that I was actually had any interest in working for. Reading was one because of the way it was seen. Took the job, and then about a year and a half ago got promoted to commercial director, which is the role that I've fulfilled now.
So what do you have to do on a day-to-day basis? I mean, it sounds quite a wide-ranging role. You talked about hospitality and merchandise and things like that. I mean, what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
So we're a small team. The areas that I'm responsible for are marketing, ticketing, merchandise, hospitality, sponsorship, advertising, and also groups and events. Groups and events look at school ticketing, grassroots football clubs, etc. We also do a lot of work with the Community Trust as well on ticketing initiatives and etc. So the day-to-day work is very, very varied. You know, one minute you can be talking to the owners about some of the activity that we've got planned. We're looking at opening a shop in the Oracle, which is due to, I think, open next week. We can be talking to sponsors about some of the activation opportunities they've got, through to kind of planning Christmas activity. We do a grotto in hospitality every year for the kids. It's a whole host of different activities. So every single day is varied. Every single day is different. Keeps me on toes.
Very much so. I'm just going to pick you up on ticketing, because I'm going to sort of sprinkle in some questions we've had from Tile Hurst End listeners. And on the ticketing front, Josh Harrington wanted to know, what are your opinions on the £10 tickets for under 24s, and should this be extended to an older age to increase attendances?
Opinions on the £10 ticket, all in favour of it, because it was myself and the ticketing team that came up with it. So we, you know, we're constantly looking at gaps here, and how we can bring more people through the doors. One age group that we saw that there'd been a decline in, the old age groups used to be 17 to 21. It's been a kind of shift now. People stay in education longer. People have less disposable income, particularly that particular age group. They go off to university, sometimes take a gap year. So actually people are coming out of university later. So that 18 to 24 age group seemed like a real good target group for us. Also, there, you know, you can see it on a match day. That kind of age group is about atmosphere, etc. So yeah, we wanted to engage with them, wanted to find ways of bringing them through the doors. So we took the decision to change it and bring the price down. So I'm all in favour of it. I think it's been very successful. We seem to have got a lot of good feedback to it. In fact, I think this season, probably 22 out of the 24 championship clubs now have an 18 to 24 age bracket. So we took the lead on it and people have copied us. Which is really, really good to see. In terms of extending it out to older age groups, we've got very good pricing here. We introduced a £20 ticket in the Eamon Dolan stand.
Yep.
We backed 20's plenty. It's not just about ticket pricing that brings people through the doors. We've given a greater range on our season tickets and on our match tickets. Attendances are slightly down this year, as most people would have seen. So it's not just about pricing. Form affects it, perception of the club, etc. So there's lots of factors that go into it. We also have to be realistic about the commercials of the football club.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very, very expensive business to be in. Just a stadium, running a stadium, stewarding, catering staff, all of those kind of things have a cost to it. So there's only so low that you can bring it. But I think we're at a stage now where we do have very fair pricing. Extending into the adult age range, I don't know whether that would necessarily work, but I still think we offer some really, really good pricing for all age groups now.
Yeah, and especially, I mean, with relegation back to the Championship a few years ago, it's a more important aspect to get your money in through the door is through the gates. I mean, a Premier League team, you know, a drop of 3,000-4,000 people is not going to make a difference when they're raking hundreds of millions. For Fred and I imagine it's quite a big sort of concern and area you're really keen to target.
It is a concern. We have to balance off getting a good atmosphere and getting as many people through the doors as possible versus the commercials of the football club. You know, it's important for people to realise that we're all football fans. We speak to a lot of football fans. We speak to a lot of supporters. We're not detached from them. We understand the economic challenges that they face. You know, we really do. I'm a football fan myself. You know, I was up until 2 years ago, 3 years ago, a season ticket holder at Fulham. But gave
we won't
that
hold
up
that against you.
No, don't hold that against me. But gave
I
that
mean, you
up.
You did get us relegated, but we won't hold it against you. Carry on.
So you know, we're not out of touch. We understand what the challenges are that supporters face. So we've tried to take a very balanced view of getting good ticket pricing without compromising too much the commercials of the football club.
Absolutely. Mark, moving back to you, I mentioned that drop from the Premier League to the Championship. I mean, how different is the football club from a media point of view when you're in the Premier League compared to when you're in the Championship?
Well, I think our job is very much split between internal media and external media. So in the Championship, it's very much a case of internal has a lot of our focus. We're trying to get through our content through our own media channels, our website, our social media streams, our programme, YouTube, you know, the online TV station, any way we can as a football club. Of course, we have press requests to come in, a lot of them, especially with a manager of Yapstam's profile. But it's not the same level of interest as it is in the Premier League, where external media takes up most of our time. So a lot of our time is spent filtering out the right types of interview requests that would suit our football club and our players and our manager, looking after them, arranging them, organising them, and making sure that the football club comes across in a good way, basically. So it's a battle to get across the football club into different media streams in different ways. So yeah, in the Premier League, it's driven by external, and in the Championship, it's more driven by us as a football club.
Yeah, you might be able to hear a lawnmower in the background, the Modesa Stadium pitch being diligently worked on to make sure it's nice for that Burton game in a couple of weeks' time. Staying on the media front, Mark's asked the question, Barcelona banned player interviews outside their own channels this week. Are you guys tempted to move more media in-house, or is it something you've already done?
Well, I mean, as I just alluded to, it's sort of a battle between internal and external, and Barcelona will not need too much interest to gain too much interest in their football club. Everyone knows Barcelona, their players, and what they're doing without any sort of deals with external media. So, I mean, they have so much interest in itself, whereas, I mean, we definitely need the media, our local media, especially to push our message out. We use our internal media streams to connect with our supporters as best we possibly can, and I think we do quite a good job of that. But we're not just trying to talk to the season ticket holder who comes on a Saturday afternoon. We're trying to, as Adam alluded to, get more people through the gate. So we're trying to talk to the person who's only been to one game in the last couple of years, who's sitting down with his dinner in front of South today at 6:30 in the evening, and we want Reading Football Club to enter his life, and we can't really drive that by our internal media streams. We have to use the external media to try and get our message across.
How much has social, you've been here a long time, you alluded to at the start, how much has social media changed your job? I mean, 10 years ago, if I'd said Twitter and Facebook, you know, we'd be sat with blank faces, you know, you're talking Reading Evening Post, Reading Chronicle, and an internet site. Nowadays, it's Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, everything under the sun. I mean, how much is that? Has it made your life easier or harder?
A little bit of both. If your question is how much has it changed it, I'd say entirely. When I first joined in 2004, there was no such thing as social media. That's how old
is
I am.
Like a friendly person in the press room.
Yeah, it just didn't exist. There was no, you know, it just wasn't a way for football clubs to get their message across. So, whereas now, obviously, as you alluded to, I mean, we build on it every single year. So, in the year that I've been in charge of the department, we've added Snapchat to our arsenal. We've added LinkedIn. We sort of relaunched Audioboom. We started using. It's Periscope we use to launch our kit at one stage. So, you know, it's not just Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. It just keeps growing. And it obviously entirely changes how we work. If we talk about 2004 when I arrived, there were three people in the media team then that looked after football comms. If I allude to what I said earlier in terms of our team, there were three people who look after football comms. Mm-hmm. And yet, the manpower is exactly the same, but the workload in terms of social media has gone through the roof. So we spend a lot of time making sure that the right stuff is put through the right media channels, and we're connecting with as many supporters in the full demographic as possible. It's constantly developing. We've got to keep our finger on the pulse. But it's at the same time, it has made it a little bit easier in the fact that, again, what Adam said a bit earlier, we can connect with our supporters directly, so we get feedback instantly. Now, that feedback might be skewed slightly, so if we've lost 3-0, we could offer every supporter £100 and they'd still come out with some negative comments.
I'm in favour of that policy, by the way. Can I just put it on record?
Whereas if we win, then, you know, everybody's happy, and it's obviously skewed by the results. But it's easier to connect with the supporters, which is what social media is all about.
I imagine both of you obviously pay close attention to what people say. I mean, how do you filter through it? Because I can only imagine, I mean, we get 20, 30 responses to a tweet and I find it hard to scroll through. I mean, you guys must get hundreds of times. Do you literally have to sit through and read all of them?
It's difficult.
And do you want to throw your phone at the wall by the end of it?
It's difficult. We monitor it. We monitor social media. The thing about social media is very reactionary. So you get people's instant reaction to absolutely everything that we do. Results, kit launch, ticket prices, etc. Whether that's true feedback, I don't know whether 100% it is, because it's a lot of the time led by emotions. We try and do other things to capture feedback rather than just take it across social media. So we've introduced, you know, supporter forums, which we do at various times across the year. I know one of our owners, Tiger, met with some supporters recently.
Yeah, I was in one of those meetings. Very good.
So things like that gives us a bit more of an opportunity, one, to get honest and open feedback from people, but also for us to be able to respond to it properly. As Mark said as well, one of the hardest things is actually responding to so many people on social media. With the comms team that we've got, it's very difficult to go through absolutely every single comment that's on there and respond to it in the correct way.
So if one of our listeners is out there thinking, I've got some genuine feedback beyond a two-word rant about the performance, I mean, what would you advise them is the best way to actually get in touch with someone at the football club? Is it a phone call? Is it a letter? Is it an email?
We do respond to certain things on social media. So it's not that we don't, we do. It's just a question of resource and the volume of things that come through. So you can always call customer services. You can always email customer services. You can always, you know, I get plenty of emails come through directly to me, which I've got absolutely no issue with. If we don't talk to supporters and they don't give us feedback, as long as it's good, open, honest feedback, you know, that helps us shape the club. That's what we're here to do. You know, the whole point of the football club, from our point of view, is to make this a better place for supporters to be. So using their feedback, is invaluable.
We touched on social media from the club's point of view. Obviously, the other avenue that's opened up is that social media is available to footballers, to players now. A lot of them have got Twitter accounts, Instagrams and things like that. What sort of policy do the club set out? I mean, do you sit down and talk to a new signing, sort of saying, OK, well, we've got certain things we'd like you to do and don't, or is it just a case of common sense? I mean, how is it handled today?
I'll be honest with you, we don't do an awful lot, and the main reason behind that is because I think in the last few years, footballers can be trusted a lot more with what they're doing on social media. As you've seen, there have been pitfalls, high profile pitfalls that footballers have fallen into, but I think footballers, they're not stupid, they're clever people, they're grown adults, they know what they're doing, and they know what the dangers are of social media. Don't get me wrong, they need some advice at some stage. The PFA and the FA come and speak to our players usually once a year, I think, and give them a little do's and don'ts and give them a few examples of what they could have done better using their social media. But also, it's worth pointing out that at Reading, we've very much been privileged with a good crop of players. Now, I'm not saying that they've all been angels, but we haven't really had too many issues, touch wood, with any social media posts or reactions, and hopefully that's down to the kind of character we've recruited. There's always a lot of talk about the Reading way and the people that we recruit, and that's through the managers we've had, and of course Nick Hammond and now Brian Teverton. And I think that's not just good footballers, that's good characters, good people, and generally I've been dealing with good people in my 12 years at Reading Football Club, and that's part of the reason we don't do an awful lot of social media training, because we have trust in them to do the right thing.
When
there's a new signing, though, what you pointed out is what we do. Pretty much the first question we ask at a new signing when he's put his pen to paper is, are you on Twitter, are you on Instagram? Because largely we want to try and manage when we put that press release out, so we need to put the press release on the website, so maybe give it half an hour or so and ask them if they're on Twitter and Instagram, so that they don't know not to stick a photo of them shaking hands with the chief exec before we step it on our website. But of course, when we hear a rumour that we might be signing a certain player, we have a look at their Twitter feed if they've got one, or their Instagram account, just to try and gauge what sort of character they are. But As I said, most of the players we've signed, if not all of them, have been very good on Twitter and social media.
Yeah, I was going to ask, obviously we had the situation with Andre Gray at Burnley, and a lot of Burnley fans were saying, well, how on earth did the club not pick up on this when you went and spent £8 million on him? I mean, is it put to you, do you get Bryant Evelyn or Yapstam coming to you saying, we're thinking about signing this, would you mind just giving a detailed look through, and how detailed is it? Because, I mean, obviously, those tweets were 4 years before
exactly.
he signed.
I mean, we've already talked about how much time social media takes. A lot of clubs, especially in the Premier League, have one or teams of people purely looking after social media.
Wow.
A lot of people in the Championship have people just looking after social media. Now, if that was the case, maybe we'd have the time to do some research and give a little bit of feedback to the manager or the director of football or the CEO. But realistically, we don't do that. We haven't looked at that. Trawling back 4 years to look at tweets they've done a long time in the past just isn't really feasible. Of course, you can Google them and you have a little look and see if they've had fallen into any of those traps before, and then you might flag something up and just say, just be a little bit careful, either with the player themselves or the people who are signing him, and just say, look, be a little bit careful in the future or whatever. But no, in general, we just trust them to do the right thing.
And one of the funnest things on social media from the club in recent years is when you launched the kit literally into space. Now, was that this season's kit? Was that the season before? My brain is going fuzzy in my
this
old age.
Kit.
This season's kit. Who came up with that? Was that you?
It was a team effort. We've said it before, we're a small team and we're always kind of throwing around ideas. How can we do things differently? You know, reality is football seasons, it's cyclical, and you end up, every year there's a kit launch, every year there's a season ticket launch. And it's quite challenging sometimes to come up with different ways of bringing that to life. So we sat down, we batted a few ideas around, and I think there was something a long time ago where somebody had taken Kingsley and sent Kingsley into space. And we kind of used that as the idea behind it. And, the clue's in the title, kit launch. So we thought, what can we do differently? Well, let's launch it into space. And the feedback and the reaction to it was really, really good.
Did it ever come down?
It did.
Yeah.
It did come down. Somewhere in Norwich or Cambridge or
really?
Somewhere. Yeah, yeah.
We actually had to track it. So what happens is you strap it to in effect a weather balloon.
Yeah.
And it goes up to a certain height. The weather balloon pops and then it, floats down to Earth ideally. And we had to track it because it was a kit that hadn't been launched yet. So if it fell anywhere where someone got their hands on it and started taking pictures of it.
Oh, so this was actually before...
Slightly difficult.
Okay, fair enough. On the kit front, we actually had a question from Johnny. In one of the more controversial kits of recent years was the one before, the African Violet away kit. He wants to know, how well did it sell compared to other away kits? Because it was one of those sort of Marmite-y kits.
Exactly the phrase I was going to use is Marmite kit. And the thing with kits is you've got your home kit. It's always going to be blue and white hoops. And with your away kit, you've got to try different things every year. African Violet, it definitely got a mixed reaction, but actually it sold really well because from a marketing point of view, people were talking about it already. And there was a lot of comments, yes, I hate it, yes, I love it, but it drove sales. Lots of people took it because it was the first time we'd done a kit like that.
How much say do you guys have, and the football club in general, on kits? Because I noticed, and we've noticed a lot of years, that Puma, there's kind of these templates that they put out, and you see a lot of teams now wearing the same sort of away kits. I mean, how much say do you have on the colours, the style?
We have a fair amount of input. Yes, we work to templated kits, but the templates have a lot more flexibility than they're used to in them. So they will start off with an initial set of designs that they're going to use, and then they'll be shown to us, and we get to start working on areas that we want to change. So this year's a good example. I think we're the first, or if not the first, one of the first clubs to ever done the faded hoop on the back, so the number pops out. So that was a kind of design decision with Puma, that we could do something slightly differently. The process takes a long time. It is quite complicated. I mean, we've already started the design process probably about 3 months ago for next season's kits, the same with training wear. And then that will go through a whole different range of iterations of kit. That then needs to be seen by the board. It then needs to be seen by potential sponsors. It needs to be seen by the owners. That then comes back. We feed back, and slowly but surely the kit for the new season evolves. But yeah, we get a fair amount of input into it nowadays.
Because that's one of the things I've noticed is that our kit launches tend to be a lot later than, I mean, you see sometimes kit teams now are wearing their new kit for next season in the last game of this season. I mean, is there a particular reason? Because it tends to only sort of be released sort of a couple of weeks before the season kicks off. Is that a decision that you guys make, or is that something that just comes from the whole process in Puma?
So it depends. There's a whole range of factors that go into that. One, it depends on the season we've had before. You know, if we've had a bad season, and you know, the reality is we've not had the greatest league seasons over the last few years, launching a kit straight away at the end of that season, you're kind of almost launching a kit into negativity. So there doesn't seem much point doing that a lot of the time. If the design process takes slightly longer than we hoped it to, the way that it has sometimes worked, we'll work with a, you know, Puma will say to us, right, kits need to be signed off by in a week's time, otherwise you missed your factory slot. If you missed your factory slot, you can be another 2 months waiting for kits to be manufactured. So there's a whole range of factors. Sponsors, you know, if the sponsors aren't happy with the way that their logo looks, or you've changed sponsor, or you're looking to change sponsor, then you need to wait for them to approve certain things as well. We have launched kits earlier, we've launched kits slightly later. Does it necessarily affect sales? It really doesn't have a huge impact. This season was a really good example. Actually, we launched late for a number of different reasons, partly because we were sending the kit into space and there was a lot of work that went behind the scenes, but kind of fans did a lot of our own marketing, and there was so much talk about the kit launch that it was really, really anticipated.
Yeah, I love the there's always speculation on the fans forums. Everyone puts out their own templates and things like that. It's always a good little guessing game on how to do it. We've had a question from Tom as well, and I'll put this to both of you as fans of football for a long time. It's from Tom Hugh Jones. He says, why do you think a large contingent of long-time traditional 18 to 40 working class fans have become disenfranchised with the club? And what are you doing to re-engage them? So first of all, I mean, do you sort of agree with that statement? Or
I think I agree. I wouldn't say a huge proportion, but there is definitely a percentage of fans who sit within that 18 to 40 age bracket who have disengaged with football in general. I wouldn't say it's limited to Reading Football Club. This issue is, you know, lots of football clubs are talking about it at the moment. There's, for me, again, lots of different reasons behind it. Football clubs have changed. There's no getting away from that. You've got foreign owners coming into the game. You've got players who aren't sourced locally. I mean, I mentioned earlier that I work for Masters Football, and the change that I saw in that, when Masters Football first started, all of the players live within about 20 miles of the stadium. And then suddenly we were dealing with Middlesbrough, who had
people like Juninho.
So, you know, trying to run a Masters Football event, you were trying to fly them in from Brazil. There's certain things that have changed in terms of the type of players that play for a football club, the type of owners. There's more money in football, and I think certain people see it as more of a business, which isn't the greatest things for fans. But fans are also driving that. I think that's the interesting thing behind it. Football clubs have changed, but also fans are demanding that. You know, the local owners, there's very few Steve Gibsons in this world now who can afford to fund a football club.
It's John Medeski, even.
Exactly. So, you know, the money that fans want to see in their club now to buy the next striker, to buy the next midfielder, to fund the academy, a lot of that needs to come from foreign investment. Also, we see it on the concourses. You know, people's expectations of what they get from a football club have changed now. People don't just want a terrible pie and a pint and to sit in a cold, damp, terrible stadium. They want good food on the concourse. They want good beer. They want the toilets to be, you know, sparkling clean. They want their stewards to engage with them in a certain way. They want the turnstile staff to act in a certain way. So there's a lot of changes that are driven both by the money in game and you know, within the fan bases themselves, I think. In terms of how we're trying to deal with it, I think that, you know, you saw it with the Liverpool example earlier in the last year, where they tried to put prices up. So price can be a factor for some clubs, which is why we've always tried to stick to very competitive pricing, so that price isn't a factor for why people would stay away. Personalisation for the stadium, we've tried to do a lot more around that. So we've got things like the fan zone outside with the Heineken unit and the West Barks ale unit. We've just put a lot of player imagery into the Windsor Lounge, which has been done up so supporters feel like they've got a bar there. We've put fan artwork at the back of the East Stand, and we've done some of the perimeter.
The Eamon Dolan stand.
The Eamon Dolan stand. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we're kind of trying to do to engage with that that demographic. I know we get accused as a club of sometimes being far too family orientated, and, you know, that's feedback that we have taken on board. Do we need to bring new fans into the club? 100% we do. We need to find ways of growing this fan base and boosting attendance, but we don't want to do that to the detriment of the 18 to 40 fan base, which is why we're trying these different things. You know, we're always trying to innovate and find ways of getting them through the doors. And a lot of the ideas that we've had, you know, like the Royals Rendezvous unit, was driven by supporter feedback. That came from a fans group to get them through. You know, the 106 ale, let's have our own ale. You know, how do we make that happen? Well, we use our partners to make it happen. But again, it was driven by fan feedback. You know, we don't want to sanitise this stadium so much that fans don't want to come through the door. So we need to find that bit of personalisation. And, you know, we want them to come back. We want them to feel engaged. And, you know, we're trying lots of things behind the scenes to make that happen.
What do you think, Mark? Obviously, a lot of sort of the insinuation is that's almost Elm Park crowd. And I know that, again, a lot of people will take quite easy cheap pops at the social media, at the Twitter feed, and they say, oh, why are you putting that out, or your match report, or why aren't you asking tough questions and stuff like that? I mean, how do you balance that? I mean, Adam's hinted that you've got to try and appeal to as many people as possible, but how do you really, from a social and a communications standpoint, get back in touch with that core sort of, I said, Elm Park audience?
Well, as we've again already alluded to, it's very difficult to please absolutely everybody, especially on social media. So even if you do a project that you think is really worthwhile and very well executed, you're still going to get its negative comments. But all we can say is, I think, again, what Adam has alluded to is that we're trying to make this place a better place for everybody to come to. We could just sit back in our chairs and just go from game to game, much like probably the club did 10, 20 years ago when some of these supporters were going to Elm Park or coming to the early days at Medeski Stadium. Or we could just keep trying to do projects that engage our supporters and bring us closer to the town. For example, the team photo is looked after by our department, and we took the team photo into town and put it in front of the line in Forbury Gardens. That was purely to try and engage with the people in the town. It didn't make our life easier. It's much easier if we could just bring them to the stadium and get all the chairs laid out in our own time and get all the players in. And I'm sure the players would have much preferred it in private. But actually, bringing them to town, they engaged really well with the people who came to watch. It made for a really good team photo. And that it's just projects like that, something new, innovative ways that try to connect with as many people as possible, whatever the age group.
You mentioned the fan experience, and we've talked about the engagement and all the great things that are going around outside the stadium, inside the stadium. One of the more controversial, and I'll hold my hands up and coining his name, is DJ Megaparty, who replaced a much-loved, long-time announcer, and came in a couple of seasons ago, and he's a Marmite figure. He's divided opinion. Some people are saying, yeah, he's great, he engages, and other people are saying, well, he's more suited to, I don't know, standing in the middle of a market trying to sell vegetables than announcing a football team. First of all, why was the decision made to change the announcer, and what sort of feedback have you been getting from that?
Atmosphere here is one of the constant things that gets thrown at me by supporters, by the board, by the owners. You know, what can we do to improve atmosphere here? If you keep doing the same things, you're going to get the same results. We wanted to freshen things up. We wanted to take a bit of a different approach. PA announcers, I think, in general, are Marmite figures. See them all around at different grounds, all around the country. DJ Megaparty is somebody I know from Masters Football. He does a lot of ice hockey, which is probably where that style comes from. We made the change because I wanted to freshen things up. When he first came in, I hold our hands up, you know, and he does too, that he made a few mistakes. And I think, particularly in football, if you get off on the wrong foot, it's very difficult to claw yourself back. You know, he said things like, you know, the East Block, you know, which he got derided for on social media. But what we've tried to do is take that feedback and give it to him and use it as a positive way to improve what he's doing.
I will interrupt you just to say I have actually noticed he has got a lot better and a lot toned down. So I'm going to give him his credit here. So let that be said. Sorry, carry on.
And that's come on the back of fan feedback as well. You know, we can't just, we mentioned it earlier, you get a lot of emotive stuff on social media, and you see people just genuinely hate PA announcers. They don't like goal music. They don't want things on the concourse. They don't want entertainment at halftime. So you kind of almost have to, I wouldn't say discount that, but there's lots of people who just don't want anything other than watch the football. There are lots of people, however, want that to be a bit more of a an entertaining experience, you know, trying to expand it and extend it beyond the 90 minutes. I think as football fans, we're all guilty of taking things a bit too seriously sometimes. And kind of just looking at a football game, this is my club, how dare anyone come in and, you know, be positive about it, you know, it's up for me, I'll decide when I'm positive or not. But yeah, he's come in, he's done things differently. I think the halftime game's great. He does a lot of engagement with crowd. He's also somebody heavily involved in football now, so he runs his own football club, and he's definitely a Marmite figure. But I think he's improved greatly, to such an extent actually that he was here for the, I think it was the West Brom Cup game last year, and the FA were here, and they liked what he did so much they took him and used him for England. So he can't be doing all that.
Yeah, you've got to give people time. And as I said, to be fair, when he first came in, I could not believe it. But yeah, to his credit, he has improved. So I'll give him. I'm interested in his own football club now.
Yeah,
what's his football club?
So he runs a football club called Hatch Warren Phoenix.
I'm disappointed it's not DJ Mega Party FC. But
no, the interesting thing about it, he's got a couple of kids, both involved in football, and he didn't like the way that a lot of the football clubs that he took his kids to were parents very aggressive, coaches very aggressive. If you weren't good enough, you were immediately out. You'd got no coaching, you weren't involved. And so he decided to start his own football club. And that has now expanded to, I think they've got something like, they cover anything from under sevens up to about under 14s. Wow. They've got different, they've got three or four different teams at each age group. They've got sponsors, their FA Star Chartered Standard. So, you know, he's somebody that's learned to love football. And he loves his time at Reading. He really does enjoy it here, despite some of the criticism he's
got. I'm gonna have to get him on a future show to let him have his side of the story. Mark, I'll go back to you. We talked about players, and you talked about, you know, I'm sure players, you know, would maybe fancy doing things in a certain way. You've worked here for so many years and dealt with hundreds of players now. Mm. We have had a question in for who, from Ollie, as in who have been the easiest and trickiest players to deal with. Now, I can understand if you don't want to name too many names, especially if they're still at the football club. But have there been any individuals in particular you've really loved to work with or really been like, oh, I have to go to him and ask something? Yeah.
They're obviously, naturally, there are the players that are a bit more amenable to doing media and doing press and doing things for the community, and some that are less. But as I said earlier, I think we've been very blessed with the groups that we've had together in my time at the football club. They've been such good people. Footballers get a bad rap a lot of the time, but we have good characters at our football club. So I won't name too many of the trickiest players, largely as well, because they can change. You know, some players who sometimes would be very standoffish and less keen to do certain things would change. Maybe they, you know, it's affected by family life, or they've just grown a bit older a few years down the line, or they have kids, or, you know, maybe it's just related to the result. You know, if you lose, people are upset and disappointed and don't want to do things. And if you win, then they do. So, you know, it's difficult to say that some of the trickiest players, but I mean, some of the best players, hopefully this comes across in the comms that we've done over the time I've been here. And so hopefully you'll agree, but the guys that are really good to us off the pitch, I could name some from back in the day, the Irish boys, Doyle, Long, the Hunt brothers, Ivar, those guys were always very approachable. They'd always use your name, they'd always ask how you were and how your family were. Those sort of simple things are very important when you're having short conversations with footballers, and those players always did that. In the other promotion season under McDermott, the likes of Jay Tabb, really nice guy. Joby was fantastic off the pitch, a great captain. He got a lot of criticism for whether he was...
He wasn't a rant or a rave, he wasn't exactly a shouter on the pitch, but he did seem that off-the-pitch leader
role. He was a perfect role model. Jem,
Ledge, all great guys, still very connected to the football club. Obviously, we've got Ledge here now. Mm. Jem's still on Twitter every two seconds.
Did I see Noel Hunt here at the Oval game the other day?
Yep, and Joby was at Arsenal, and Noel Hunt was actually recently, just yesterday, was at the opening of a 3G pitch at the John Medeski Academy. So, still very connected to the football club. That's what you see in the really good players. The current crop are great. Don't get me wrong, there are some really good guys. George Evans, Chris Gunter, John Swift, Liam Moore, Ali Al-Habsi, I think I haven't even mentioned him.
Yeah.
He's probably one of the nicest guys you could possibly meet in just inside or outside of football. He's just an unbelievably nice guy. So, yeah, some players are easier, some players are more difficult, but generally we've had a good
Do you handle sometimes, obviously, as football's developed over the last few years, lots more foreign players come in. Do you have a problem with the language barrier?
Well, generally they've all learnt enough English to get by.
Do you have to set that up as a communication department? Do you have to set them up with language lessons, or that's something done
not
by the football
department? It is done at the football club, yeah. It's done sort of on the football side of things, so language tutors come to the training ground and speak to those players and teach them the English language. Some want to do it more often, are very keen to do it, and some just do it because the club has sort of put it in place. But to be honest, we haven't had many that... I'm trying to think. I mean, to be honest, the most problems we have in terms of language is players pretending they can't speak the language they can't.
And I was going to say,
Jimmy Kebbe
was notorious for this. In that, whenever you would put a microphone in front of his face, and like Berkshire would like give it the whole, "Oh, I don't understand what you're saying," and then you'd always hear from fans like, "Oh, I saw him down the casino and had a great long conversation with him."
When he wanted to say something, he'd suddenly speak quite good English. But you get to gauge these players and work out, you know, who's trying to play the language card to not get to get out of doing stuff and who isn't. So we try and share all the media out, so it's not like the foreign players get away with it. We'll make sure that Dennis Rackles and Joseph Mendes spoke to Sky Sports recently, and obviously we've got a few Dutch players, but they all speak very good English, so the current crop are great.
Is that a decision that you make as a department, like, we would like to speak or hear from because we've not heard from them, or is it Yapstan will come to you and say, "Oh, I'm putting up player X or Y for you today"?
Depends on the manager. Some managers want a bit more control about who does the media at certain times. And we work with the manager to help do that. But Yapstan, as has probably come across in the fans forum and in his press that you've seen and the way people have seen him, he's very relaxed. And yeah, he lets us deal with that. He knows that we're trusted to sort of, you know, if we've lost 5-0, I'm not going to put a very young, inexperienced player up for some press. It'll be more of an experienced player. And equally, it's often led by what happens on the pitch. If someone's scored, then that player will do some media the next week or post-match, and that's how it's led. And the manager is very relaxed with that.
It's great to write on the good times, and we've been really lucky as a fan base. We've had some fantastic seasons over here in the recent, maybe not in the last couple of years, but before that especially. But how do you, both of you, handle when Reading are losing, when we're not doing so well? Because you can almost get back, you get that backlash, isn't it? You try and put out something positive and you go, "Well, we've just lost 3-0, 4-0. And from, like, obviously you guys have to produce match reports and things like that. I suppose, how hard do you find the balance of the commercial aspect of the club, keeping that positive atmosphere going, to the realities of what fans are actually seeing? How hard do you find to write about that and put things out?
It's difficult, but you've got to stick to the truth. I don't think... You can't put a spin on a 5-0 defeat or, you know, away from home. When we lost to Middlesbrough last year and lost in the last minute and it was freezing cold and we had to drive home and we didn't get home till 3:30 in the morning, that's sort of, you know, we don't leave, as a communications team, we don't leave an away ground before two and a half hours after kickoff because we've got all the content and all the stuff to do post-match. So when things like that happen, miles away from home and you're driving all the way home, of course you're going to get a little bit down by it and a little bit... affected by it, but you've got to you've got to report what happens. Stick to the facts. Empathise with the supporters because we're all fans. We all want to win every week. The players all want to win every week, and just try and look to the next one and push forward. Basically,
I think the important thing for us is however hard it can be, if things are going well, don't get carried away, and if things are going badly, don't get carried away, because football can change so quickly. From a professional point of view, for me, actually, it's the best part of the challenge. Still trying to deliver for your business on the commercial side of things, even when things aren't going well. You know, we're always trying to take the results out of the equation. So, you know, how can hospitality still be good, even when the results aren't good? How can you still drive kit sales, for instance, while, you know, the results aren't as good as they can be? You know, how do you get your ticketing right? How do you still bring people through the doors when results aren't going well? That can be a really good challenge sometimes. And not that you ever want to lose, but when you lose and you see good fan feedback to some of the things you can do, that can actually give you some of the greatest pleasure out of the job. But when you're winning, it's obviously great. It makes a big difference to what we do, and a lot more business comes to us. A lot more people are engaged in what we do, and you know, hopefully, you know, we're winning at the moment. Results are good. We're in the you know, we're in the fourth position in the league. Hopefully, fans will start coming back through the doors as well and start engaging with it.
It's probably one of the biggest challenges for people working at a football club is the fact that no matter how excellent your work is and how many levels you go to and how hard you work, a lot of it is a football club's success is pretty much determined by how well 11 people run around on that pitch. And you have to deal with the highs and the lows. And the lows, there's no getting away from them. You know, you've got to deal with them as you can. But the highs are what makes working at a football club so fantastic. I always say to people, there's not many jobs where you're jumping off your seat and hugging people and jumping around. But in this job you do. I mean, when we went to Wembley for the semi-final, we ended up putting a GoPro camera on our desk, purely by chance, actually, because we didn't need it, because we had multiple angles, obviously, FA Cup semi-final. And it was on our press desk. And when Gavin Cleary scored the goal, the footage, you would see it's just carnage, basically. And, you know, you lose a little bit of professionalism. Soon we start tweeting and carry on with the match report. But we want the team to win, and it makes our lives much better when they do. So, you know, it's the highs and lows, and deal with them as they come.
The other thing that's, again, you touched on it earlier, the ownership changes we've had over the last few years. How is this ownership group to deal with in comparison to others? But probably more pertinent to you, given that you've been through the three regimes that we've had in recent years. How do this group compare, and how easy are they to work with?
They're very good to work with. There's a, obviously, this is new to us in terms of they don't. So John Medeski lived at the stadium. This ownership
is he still in his penthouse here?
Yeah,
has he moved?
Yeah, he's still up there. Yeah. So, but obviously he was a Reading man. He lived in Reading. Yeah. He's been 25 years. So any change away from that is going to be different. And we've moved away to two foreign owners, who spend a lot of their time not living in the country. So it's about trying to connect the fans with the new ownership, and equally connect the owners to what the football club is all about, and what its aims and ambitions are, and what the supporters think of this and that and the other. So that's probably the challenge, trying to bridge that gap. It's not something we've had to do before Sir John Sir John Medeski's sort of tenure. But they've been very good to work with in terms of they're connected. I mean, I'm sure you've heard a lot from Tiger when he's done his press, and it's not like he doesn't listen or he's distant. He's engaged with the football.
The thing that came across to me was how clued up he was. It's very easy to think that, oh, these people are just pumping their money, but he knew right down to the minutia of how certain players played. So that was a really pleasing thing.
I remember
thing.
We put a piece on the website from the owners at the end of last season, which was obviously a bad season. We didn't do very well, and we put a piece on the website, and there was a few social media comments, not loads, but a few, sort of suggesting that we'd put it together and it hadn't come from them. But you know, the input is all from them. Tiger wanted to include stuff about Tariq Fozu and how well he done on loan. You know, this sort of information, people think that there's a load of spin behind it, but actually it's not. The owners are very much engaged in this football club and wanted to succeed as much as the supporters.
Yeah, Adam, how much autonomy do you get? Because, you know, Matt mentioned they're away from the country, they've got businesses of their own to run. How much are you left to get on with it? Or is it a case of everything sort of has to be signed off and you have to wait for news from Thailand?
It's definitely the relationship with the owners has progressed. So when we first started, they're learning about us, they're learning about football, they're learning about the club. Now they've come to see how we work, see that the decisions we make for the football club are the right ones. So a lot of the time I'm left to get on with giving advice to them and saying, this is what I believe is the right strategy for away ticket pricing or season ticket pricing, or this is what I think is the best thing for the club on kits or, you know, fan engagement. And the majority of the time they take that on board. And I think you can see, you know, there's other clubs out there who haven't taken on board what their commercial team or their media team have said, which has led to drastic price rises for home fans, away fans, kits which, you know, have been not well received. But yeah, there's a, they trust us to get on with things. We speak to them very often. I've travelled to away games quite often with Tiger as well. Last time he was over, we went up to Rotherham. So, you know, they let us get on with things. And I think the reason why they do that is because they can see that a lot of the things that we're doing are the right things for the football club that they own.
Yeah, a couple of final questions, because you've given us loads of your time already, so thank you for that. So I'll wrap up with a couple of questions. Sort of looking ahead, one of the questions came in from Matt Castle, who says, how likely is it that we'll sell the stadium naming rights, and if so, how soon?
Well, I think the owners and the board, I think, have already given a kind of answer on that and alluded to the fact that it's more than likely that it will happen, but stadium naming rights isn't something you just give away easily or cheaply. Particularly for a
stadium.
Is
my £10 offer
like
for the Tyler Stone Stadium not going to wash?
It's not been accepted just yet.
Unbelievable.
No. But I think, you know, the brands that we work with here are important, and we have had offers on the stadium before to take the stadium naming rights. They haven't been to the right level or the right brands. So that's what we're, you know, we're ideally want to get to a position where we find the right company to take over the naming rights if and when that opportunity presents itself, which, you know, the owners have covered. From a financial point of view, it makes sense as well. If you can do it, then we will do, but there's no rush.
And how much of the football club involved with the ongoing plans for Royal Elm Park? Is that something that's been taken away from you guys? Is it been handled by someone else, or is it something that you guys are still heavily involved with?
On a day-to-day basis, it doesn't have any influence on us. Do I think it's, you know, it could be very exciting, I think, if it goes ahead. Our CEO, Nigel Howe, he's the main person from involved with Reading Football Club who is driving that with the owners. So from a day-to-day point of view, no, we don't have any input into the designs, the plans, the comms around it or anything like that. But we're aware of it. We keep an eye on it. I think it's important that we know what's happening with it, because there are knock-on implications for how we deal with travel, etc. Moving forward. But not a huge amount of involvement, but we're aware of what's going on.
I've asked you guys lots of questions over the last hour or so, and again, thank you very much for it. Just, I'd just like to offer both of you the chance, if you've got any messages to fans or anything you'd like to sort of get out there, or anything from your point of view that you said, oh, actually, I really wanted to sort of say to fans, you know, X or Y. Is there anything you'd like to say?
I think from my point of view, it's making sure that people... because it's very hard sometimes, and the reason why an opportunity like this is something that we wanted to go ahead with is because I think we're the people that you never hear from at a football club. You know, we've got a very small dedicated team here who come in every day, and I can promise you this, because I see it and I do it and Mark does it. You know, we are dedicated to making this a better football club. And we're doing that because we want supporters to be proud of the football club that they are associated with. We want Reading Football Club to be the best football club it can be. The things that I really want to see, I think we all do, how do we get more people through the doors? You know, we try a huge number of activities to bring supporters through the gates. And when we try those, I think it's important that supporters back us, season ticket holders back us to do that. You know, we need people to be brand advocates and talk about this football club and tell their friends, you know what, this is a really good place to be. You know, we want this to be a good club. And I think with that, we'd really want the atmosphere, you know, anyone who's got any ideas about atmosphere and improving the atmosphere, come forward and share it with us. Because, you know, I've talked to a huge number of football clubs about what they've done. And the reality is, the club can only do so much. They can only take it so far. We'll always try different things, but the fans are the ones that have to drive that. They're the ones that have to, if they want the atmosphere to be better, they've got to be sat in Y25, Y26, singing consistently. They're the ones that have got to be, you know, bringing the drums in or bringing a megaphone in or bring whatever they think that they can bring in to enhance the atmosphere here. So any feedback that they've got on that, You know, we'd love to hear it because that's what we all want to see. There's nothing better than, particularly night games, 24,000 people in here, night game, and it's rocking. That is unbelievable. And with the way that the team's playing and the manager's brought into what the club's about and how he's taking the team forward, this is a good time to be here.
Yeah. It's important to say that we're not. It's not a closed shop like Adam's saying. We need the supporters to come to us with ideas ourselves. We won't sit back and rest on our laurels and just keep going from game to game. We're coming up with as many new different projects, different content to try and engage supporters and the people of Reading. But if fans have ideas that can make this place a better place to be for all of us, then come to the fans forums, speak to customer services, come and speak to us if you want to. You know, we're open to listening to all supporters' suggestions. It's difficult when you're surrounded by social media. As we've said, it's skewed. It can be very negative and people can start getting a little bit wound up thinking that things aren't going our way. But actually, it's a good football club. We're doing very well at the moment and we just want to make it better. And any supporters that can help us in that, we're willing to listen and we want to hear all those ideas.
Absolutely. Well, again, thank you both very, very much for giving your time up for this interview, for the podcast. It's been great. I've learned loads, and hopefully supporters who are listening to this will as well. You mentioned sort of communication. What's the best sort of email? Is there a particular email address or something to get you guys on or get to the club? Or
so the main route for people to go to with ideas or suggestions or feedback would be through customer services. So yeah. The customer services email is on our website. If you need to speak to the programme or the big screen, all of these different contact numbers or email addresses are in the match day programme on a Saturday or a Tuesday. So just take note of them, and that's the way to get your feedback. I mean, we spoke about social media and you can get your points across there, but realistically we can't reply to everybody. We can't sift through all those comments. So we try our best with our hashtag Royal Reply and get back to as many fans as possible to try and take on board feedback. But that's not the best way to get customer service points across. If you want to get a serious point, a serious idea, of course, come through customer services, come through people who you meet on a Saturday, and that's how to do it.
I can only imagine the amount that your battery goes through your phone if you are hooked up to the club's Twitter account. It would go from 100 to zero. It's straight away, and non-stop end of vibrating.
It's a piece of equipment we take to most away games now, a phone charger, because yeah, it's where we record our post-match as well. So yeah, it's a much used piece of kit.
And I think with anything that we've raised today, if anyone wants to contact me directly, they're more than welcome to, and I'm quite happy to, you know, give you my email address, etc., that you can, you know, you can tag onto this and
excellent
and share with people. They can come to us directly, as Mark's just said, as I've said, this is not about being a closed shop. It's not about just, you know, us. We can't do it without other people, so come to me directly and I'll respond.
Excellent. Well, fingers crossed things continue to grow both on and off the field. Said fourth in the league, I'd love to be sitting here in a few months time talking about how we masterminded a promotion campaign. But in the meantime, gentlemen, both thank you very much indeed, and said here's to a good season.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Get social with the boys.
Find them on Twitter
at the Tarlhurst End
and facebook.com/thetarlhurstend.
Again, a very big thank you to Mark and Adam for giving up their time to speak to us. I hope you enjoyed that interview. As mentioned at the top of the show, we'll be back with a full edition of the podcast next week, talking about the Burton game. Hopefully as well, I'll be able to chat to Charles on Friday as well, just ahead of that game, to catch up with all the latest team news and information. Just before I go, again, a very big thank you to everyone who has joined the cause on Patreon, in particular to Tommy Hawthorne, Lou Burton and Hugh Willis, who have all stepped up to the plate and pledged their support to the show. Again, it means a tremendous amount to us all here at the Tireless End, you know, giving up your hard-earned cash for us here, and it will be used wisely. I said it goes to fund improvements to the show and bits and pieces like that. So thank you very much indeed. As mentioned, we'll be back hopefully Friday and then again early next week, the main edition of the show. And thank you again to Mark and Adam. But in the meantime, come on, you ass.
Get social with the boys.
Find them on Twitter
at the Tarlhurst End
and facebook.com/thetarlhurstend.